And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy and you let it. 9 to 5.
Good evening, WORT listeners. My name is Mark Thomas. I'm a retired union activist. Tonight I'll be interviewing Mary Englem and Annie Habel about their experiences as politically active working class women. So let's start with the brief bio. Mary, you want to tell us what's your life story?
Okay, quickly. I was born in Chicago, south side of Chicago, not far from where my grandmother lived and where my father was probably born. So we were part of the south side of Chicago, close to the Gary, Indiana border. One of my earliest political memories, learning that my grandfather, who died before I was born, worked for Governor Altgeld, who was, of course, a Democrat in the state of Illinois. And my father was started working in the steel mills at a very young age near the Indiana border, right across the river, right across the expressway, not then, but later, to start his career in the steel mills. But he wound up being a water system person, so he worked most of his career in the city of Chicago, working on the water system.
Was he a union worker? Did unions have much of a presence in your life when you were growing up?
Yes, he was a member of the plumbers union, which I that's probably before the AFL-CIO, so he had a plumber's card and a member of a union card at that time. What else about him? He had been in World War I. He was a Woodrow Wilson enthusiast and a Franklin Roosevelt enthusiast. So I grew up in a very politically positive or oriented toward the Democrats' environment. And so I was very interested in my father and my grandfather's political activities, but of course I didn't really understand anything about them. I do remember being in favor of the election of Harry Truman in 48, I believe it was. And of course I was very pleased when that happened, but that's, I can't tell you why I thought Truman was the man, but he was. And later, when Eisenhower had his 8 years, I kind of lost interest in politics. But by the time I got to college in 1959 or 55, I started to take a more, not serious, but somewhat enthusiastic look at local politics and national politics. I can't say that I really understood anything about Chicago politics or Illinois politics, although I didn't know that I didn't know. And then we all know, we all remember what happened after that, the 60s, the 70s, and the wars. And so my political life evolved after that.
Okay, Annie, how about you? What's your story?
Well, I grew up where there was a very positive view of labor unions. Almost everybody I knew in Irish Catholic Democratic Massachusetts were public sector employees. A lot of very recent immigrants, but cops and firefighters and teachers and postal workers, all of that unionized. More men than women, but with a very positive relationship to labor unions. So when I got my job in Madison in the early 80s as a dishwasher at a laboratory at the university, which was already unionized, I was very lucky in that I had, that I already knew people in the union, men, who I had been involved in lefty labor politics in Madison for a long time, who acted as mentors to me when I first got my job. And I was very lucky in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about your political activities before that union job? Did you have a political life before you got the state job?
Yeah. I was involved in anti-racism work, and I was involved in neighborhood activities, and I was involved in alternative education. So in all of those organizational and political things, I knew people.
Okay. How about you, Mary? You know, what were your early political involvements before you got your union job?
Well, I got my union job, to backtrack, in the 70s, when I needed a job and I took an exam, or actually got hired as an LTE first and later got hired as a permanent employee, working in the library system as a clerical employee. So that's when I first had the opportunity to join a union. And looking back at my father and grandfather, when I was asked if I wanted to join the union, I said, oh, yes, you know, where do I sign up? Not really knowing any more than that, but enthusiastic about that. So I joined the union as soon as I was eligible.
You were at the university at a library?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And was it union when you were first hired, or were you there when they organized and, you know, achieved official union status?
No, the union existed at that time. I'm sure it was relatively new. It was the clerical union for AFSCME, 2412.
Okay.
I was hired originally by Dorothy Schultz, who was the head of college library. And that name may seem familiar to some of you. Dorothy Schultz was from Minnesota originally, and she had been very active in the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota during the Depression and had done workers' education and a lot of union work before she came to Madison. So she was an inspiration to lots of people in the feminist movement and in the union movement. And she did her best to be supportive of those people. In fact, that was one of the libraries where we had a collective way of determining what our shifts would be and how we would schedule the library, which I think was kind of a collectivist effort to work together. I don't know that it always worked out, but it was her effort to teach people how to take a stab at getting their work lives and their conditions of employment a little bit in their control.
Not all the time did everything that everyone wanted to do always work out.
No.
There were a lot of struggles and a lot of failures along with the successes.
Yeah, that's for sure. Win some, you'll lose some. You were in AFSCME 2412, your local union.
Mm-hmm.
That was a clerical workers.
Right.
So it was predominantly women, I assume.
Yes, yes.
And that probably changed over the course of your career to be a little more mixed.
Well, I don't know, because I didn't stay in that job very long.
Okay.
I mean, I did stay for 7 or 8 years, but by the time I moved on, it still was predominantly women's work. And though these are the women who were the managed really the academic department all across campus. And there would be 2 people working in this office and 5 people working in that office. So very isolated from contact with union propaganda, if you want to call it that, or activism or organization. I think people in the union in 2412, except places like the library where there were a lot of clerical workers,
yeah, I saw
concentrated
that,
in a small space.
I saw that during my time at the university that there were some people like me. I had 15 coworkers, and we were all in the same room from the time we got there till the time we went home, whereas other people might have been the only union worker within sight of their mm-hmm. office. So, and you were in the blue-collar technical
union. Right. My
union
situation was somewhat different. I came into what was a predominantly male local. Locals are just a way of chopping up labor unions. Mm-hmm. So the local was the people who usually had similar kinds of work situations as you did. So when I first got started, the people I knew said, oh, come in, get involved. And I said, wait. And let me pass probation. You were in probation for a while then, and you could lose your job on probation for no reason. You had no union protections then. So I said, let me make sure I pass probation. Let me make sure I'm going to stay in this job for a while. And I did. And then I started getting involved. And I was pretty pleased in general about it. But it was an interesting situation because I was one of the few women who was very active. And I was very lucky in the sense that most of the men who were active in the union were very supportive. They were trying to get more people involved. And I didn't entertain a lot of negative ideas from the people who were in leadership positions in the local. So they wanted to get people well-trained, and they wanted people to know what was going on. I did, however, encounter some interesting things when I hadn't been working very long, because I became a steward. Most of you are probably familiar with what a steward does, but they essentially act as a workplace representative for when they're in the union's in a dispute with management. The steward is the representative. And so when I first became a steward, I would be called in a situation where management was going to discipline a person. And before they disciplined a person, the person had the right to have a steward for a little 15-minute consultation where the steward would explain their rights in the situation. And essentially, the steward would say, don't say anything. Don't admit to anything. Don't. But I'd come into a situation where I had never met the person I was going to represent, and they'd look at me and go, I don't want a girl. And I would have to say, look, in 15 minutes, you're going to sit down with management and they're going to try to fire you. You can go in there with me or you can go in there by yourself. So why don't you sit down with me and let's see if we can straighten this out. And they would. And I wouldn't get into some complicated thing about sexism and misogyny and women's roles or anything like that. I just say, this is what you get. One of the good things about our local is that we assigned jurisdictional areas to stewards. So stewards represented a certain group of people. So if you were a person in trouble, you didn't get to pick your steward because you knew their name or they were the president of the union or they were a man or they were white. You just got who you got. And that was very positive. And after a while, I didn't get that reaction anymore, but I did in the beginning quite a bit.
Can you talk a little bit about efforts to facilitate women becoming active in the union?
Yeah, I think we were very lucky in that my local wanted to get people involved and they had the resources to try to say, now this doesn't always work, try to say, what are the things that keep people from being involved? And sometimes there are things like, they need childcare. So the union would say, okay, we'll either provide childcare or we'll reimburse you for childcare if you have to get involved in union activity. Or they'd say, because we represented people 24 hours a day on all different kinds of shifts, sometimes people would need to take time off to go to a union activity, and if so, we would reimburse them for what was called the lost time. Or there were language difficulties. So we would do the union newsletter and the contract in different languages, or have interpretation at meetings for our members who spoke another language besides English or were hearing impaired. So we tried to address things that made it difficult for people to be union activists, and try to take some of those difficulties away.
Mary, how about you?
I just wanted to comment. I don't think you touched on this quite before. 171 was what you might call the blue-collar union on campus,
right.
Whereas 2412, my local, was the clerical workers' local, which meant lots of people wearing pantyhose and skirts to work instead of
plaid flannel shirts.
right. But moreover, 171 was a fair share union, was it
yes.
not? And so,
yeah, for those of you who don't know, fair share requires non-members to pay the same amount as members do because the union's legally required to provide them with representation. They can't participate in internal union structures, but the union's required to represent them, so they're required to pay an amount equal to dues,
and
whether
this only,
they're a member or not.
And this only happens if a union has reached a certain level of membership, usually a very high level of membership, where they then have a vote, and they vote whether to become a fair share union. And that usually means that almost all the people are members already, and it just requires the rest of the people. It's a very democratic process to become a fair share union, but it takes a while.
And the point is, it makes the local have a lot more, or maybe a little bit more, disposable income than...
A lot more resources, absolutely.
A lot more resources. So that's why, in part, why you could think about providing child care during
sure.
union meetings and things like that. I won't say that the clerical local had even got far enough to think about that possibility, because we just never had those kinds of resources to dispose of. But
But later on, in the 90s, I think, in the late 90s, finally, that statewide clerical union did become a fair share unit.
Oh, did. It
took a while. It takes a lot of organizing and a lot of work to get that level of membership that you can have that vote.
Yeah, I'm sure we would all agree that it's bogus that women get stuck taking care of children, but it's a fact. Can you talk a little bit about efforts at the statewide union level to facilitate women being active in the union?
I think that when Mary and I became involved, I think it's fair to say that the statewide leadership was very, very predominantly male and predominantly white. And all of us in Madison, who tended to be a little more progressive than the rest of the statewide union, tried to implement on a statewide basis a lot of things that we had implemented on a local basis, meaning the child care, meaning the language differences, meaning the lost time for representation, things like that. Of course, the first time we tried these things on a statewide level, we would always lose the votes, and we would be mocked. People would look at us like the concept of providing childcare was absolutely unheard of, or providing for people whose first language wasn't English was unheard of. But we would fight, and we would fight, and we would fight, and we would argue, and eventually we would win a lot of these things.
Yeah, nothing ever happens as fast as we would like it.
Nothing.
You were both active to one degree or another in a coalition, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, CLU. Could you talk a little bit about your roles? Mary, why don't you start what your activities in CLU were?
Well, CLU, actually, we're just past the 50th anniversary of the foundation of CLU, which occurred in 1974. So that was not only in the middle of the war protests and the feminist movement and a lot of racial issues coming to the fore. So it was a period of excitement, which I think probably did not directly speak to a lot of members of unions who were just working people who needed to earn enough money and get their kids to school and so forth. So I think CLU, being founded in 1974, was a breath of fresh air for a lot of union women who didn't come from a university background or a university environment, but came from the auto industry or the coal mining industry or the transportation issues, transportation industry, or the telephone operators, very important communication workers, very important organization. But these were people who were just right on the brink of starting to realize that their union could and should offer them the opportunity to emerge as leaders in the union movement. And that was what CLU was founded to achieve, to take regular union members and help them become union leaders.
Was CLU a part of the AFL-CIO? Was it an official union structure?
Well, no, it was not. It was a separate organization, although many members of CLU were also members of the AFL-CIO.
But CLU,
but not always.
CLU was very open to saying that its members did not have to be in a union that was an AFL-CIO union, because there were unions in the country that weren't part of the AFL-CIO, and CLU was very open to that. It was even open to women who were not in a union but wanted to be, either because they were trying to organize a union in their workplaces or they were trying to help other people organize unions. So KLUB was independent, although, as Mary said, a good portion of its members were part of AFL-CIO unions.
Right. There's tension.
We were also involved in the local labor federation, which people may be familiar with. That's a five-county group that's composed of labor unions that are all different kinds of unions. So we were public sector unions, but there were construction unions, industrial unions. They were all part of the local labor federation.
That's the South Central Federation of Labor.
The South Central Federation of Labor.
Right.
South Central Wisconsin is what the South Central refers to.
Yeah, okay, the broader union there. And, you know, there is like maybe ideologically divide is overstating it, but there's tension within the labor movement about whether we should do electoral politics or whether we should organize to seize the seize the means of production. I know that you are both active in political electoral politics to one degree or another. Could you talk a little bit about that, Mary? You want to talk about your other political activities?
My other political activities. Yeah, I guess looking back on my life, I would say that I went from one organization to the next, looking for and finding a locally organized group of people who wanted to work on what I would call broadly democratic issues, and that is not the Democratic Party, but women's issues and the environment and improving the salary of people who don't make very much money, improving the benefits that we offer to all of our citizens through as part of the social safety net. So I stayed with KLUB as long as I could. And I just want to mention one other objective of KLUB, in not only to make women more easily rise to the top of their union leadership, but also to seize family issues and issues of interest to women in benefits and salary and safety and all those issues that you run into on the job, and also to organize the unorganized. So that was a three-pronged program that KLUB offered to people to work on. And looking back on it, I think that's such an inspiring agenda. And I wish I had appreciated it more at the time. I didn't really understand it. And so I served KLUB as a secretary at the local level and things like that. Did a little bit of work as a steward, although I should mention that when I was a steward, the local was not a fair share local yet, and so we had to define everyone, even mm-hmm. though
so
we didn't
always
didn't always have a member to work on to work with us. Which meant that you would be talking to somebody who had not a clue, not, no pun intended, not a clue of why you were offering to be their steward they had a grievance at work.
You know, I grew up in a culture where labor unions were almost unheard of. You know, I had an uncle or two who had union trades jobs, but the idea that you get a job, the first thing you do is sign your union card, that was pretty foreign to me. Annie, what's your experience with the tension between political, or rather partisan political politics of electing people?
There's always a question of exactly how much. Well, Mary and I both came out of experience of working with Labor Farm Party, which was essentially a third party movement in this part of Wisconsin. that was somewhat separate from the issue of a lot of labor unions, especially AFL-CIO unions, are very closely tied to the Democratic Party. There's always a tension within the labor movement between activists who think that that's too close a representation and people who think we ought to be spending much more time on grassroots workplace things and less on, not so much less to have our members be involved in elections and electoral politics, but less a total identification relationship with the Democratic Party. That tension's always been there, and it's there now. But a lot of people active in the labor movement think you have to do some of each. You have to both educate your members about what's going on in electoral politics, but also put an enormous emphasis on workplace issues, what people want in the workplace, how to make that important, and how to get people involved in their workplace instead of expecting some electoral political party to do the work for you.
Yeah, it's a vision of a union as a service organization or a union as an organizing organization. In the service model, you pay your dues, and when you have a grievance, the union processes it for you. And other than that, you can just ignore it. One of the big challenges that we always faced as public employees was the threat to contract out our work. And the university loved that as much as anyone. I know, Mary, when you first started, you were a limited term employee, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the same job for less money with no benefits. And that was really a big issue. There were a couple things going on. One was the constant abuse of LTEs, of limited term employees. And then the other one was just the wholesale contracting out. You know, the LTE thing you could look at as kind of piecemeal contracting out, whereas the university used to occasionally get schemes where they wanted to contract out entire workplaces. Would you talk a little bit about...
There was contracting out on a small scale that they never called that. So, for instance, at one point, the university used to have 30 butchers who the cows would come in, they would do it. Eventually, little by little by little by little, they, as the butchers all retired, they stopped doing that and they just bought the meat all cut up. They never called that contracting out. But that was going on all over the place, in housing, in food service, all kinds of places. And then there was a very deliberate contracting out where they would say, we're going to get rid of this whole group of people and we're going to pay a company to do that work for us. Lots of times that was janitorial and custodial services. It wasn't the only contracting out they ever tried, but it was one of the more obvious ones because it was so easy to say, anybody can clean an office. Why, it's unskilled labor. Why are we paying people a good living wage, a family-supporting wage, to do something that anybody could do? And there was wholesale contracting out statewide over and over and over and over again. And eventually, there were two places where custodians weren't contracted out. And one was in all the legislators' offices, because they said, no, I want my custodian to clean my office. So they never contracted out the legislators' offices. And the other one was the university, because the university local put out an enormous political fight to stop the contracting out. And because it got everyone, including other unions, to be supported, the Labor Federation to be supportive, all kinds of people to be supportive, and made a scene about it and yelled and screamed about it, we won that contracting out fight. But that was the only way those contracting out fights got won. And over a period of years, you could see various places around the state where some, especially blue-collar jobs, not totally, but especially blue-collar jobs, got contracted out. And during in the prisons, there were attempts. They were never totally successful, but various legislators were always introducing bills to contract out prison employees. It was a constant struggle year after year.
Yeah, I know many states have a lot of privately run prisons. Wisconsin, I don't think, does.
But not for want of trying sometimes.
No.
And sometimes you hear of clinical staff in the prisons being contracted to a mm-hmm. private health care provider.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of smaller contracts are all over the place.
Yeah, there used to be hundreds of custodians who cleaned state office buildings in downtown Madison and, you know, did the other building maintenance. And those jobs are pretty much gone. Sad but true.
Right. When one of the other ways that we attempted, and this is a little more difficult, but we attempted to get more women involved, is we saw that you had to provide role models. So you had to have women acting in leadership roles as officers, not just as stewards, but as officers, because if other women saw women acting as officers in leadership positions, we also saw that around race. So you couldn't, it was much more difficult to get people of color, women and men of color, and women and men who were Spanish-speaking, to be involved unless they saw people in leadership positions who looked like them. That's a very difficult thing to do, but it's something that labor unions who are good understand that they have to do constantly.
Yeah, the diversity issues at the university never quite trickled down to the blue-collar workers, where there were just flat-out discrimination, you know, where there were departments that were 100% white men. And
that wasn't the union's fault. It was management's decision
right.
to hire.
Sure.
But it made it much more difficult for the unions.
And it made it that much rougher for a person of color if you did get hired. And sometimes, like, the grounds department at the university was 100% white. At one point when we looked into it, there was not a single black man hired as a union food service worker anywhere on campus. There were dozens of black men working as limited term employees and none at all working as classified.
And that limited term employee classification was a scam. There was nothing limited term about those jobs at all. They were just a way of avoiding paying people a living wage and giving them union representation.
Talk a little bit about the locals' fight with the university over the LTE thing. I know both locals were involved in it.
Well, I think to get a little bit wonky about this, you have to understand what the rules supposedly were and how they were not observed. An LTE position was supposed to be, I think, a six-month position.
Yes.
And a limited number of hours per week. So you'd always fall under the minimum for benefits, for health insurance or for retirement coverage and so on. And at the end of your 6 months, you were supposed to be let go because this was a temporary job. And a wholly new, inexperienced person would have to be hired if you still needed those services.
Or the job would not exist anymore.
Or they just keep hiring the same person.
That's not how it often happened. It often happened that LTEs kept getting renewed and renewed and renewed, and they knew their job very well, and they should have been getting all the benefits that came with permanent employment, but sometimes they were not.
Yeah, we actually made some progress on the LTE problem, primarily because of backing by student labor activists who helped us to block a referendum to build a new Union South, not once but twice, over the issues of LTEs. And, you know, if there's anyone out there that remembers the Student Labor Action Coalition, they were a steadfast ally, and they really, really gave us some bargaining power with the university over the LTE issue.
And some of those people went on later to become labor union activists all over the country, and they were wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, it was really a good thing.
One of the things we didn't talk about a little bit was the whole issue of comparable worth.
Right.
There was a recognition that, and this wasn't the unions who set this, this is management that set this, determined that the starting rate for certain wages was X, Y, Z, A, B, C, blah, blah, blah.
Comparable worth was not like there's wage discrimination where we're going to hire people to be cooks and we're going to pay the men more to cook than we're going to pay the women to cook. It was that if you took jobs with comparable responsibilities, skill level requirements,
training,
and the ones that were predominantly men paid more than the ones that were predominantly women.
And had different titles attached
right.
to them.
Right, yeah. So comparable worth was an effort statewide.
Actually, it was an effort nationally, but right. there was a statewide effort.
And how did that play out?
You know, I can't remember the details. Maybe Jenny can.
There was enough action to finally, the statewide governors and said, okay, we will investigate this, that we will look at this. And they set up a commission that investigated this for, I think, about a year, something like that. And there were all these people who did investigations of all kinds of jobs and determined what skills it took, what training it took, what responsibilities it took, blah, 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 blah. And at the end, they agreed that there was discrimination based on this comparable worth classification. And they designated certain classifications to be gone to different pay ranges, especially the ones that were women's jobs were put into higher pay ranges based on the fact that they had comparable activities as similar men's jobs. It was a big success. And the same kinds of things were going around the country, but it happened in Wisconsin.
I think there were some legal actions on it
That's
in
right.
various states, which probably increased the
That's
incentive
right.
for the state of Wisconsin to
because they saw that it was going to happen here
instead of getting drug into court.
That was going to happen here. There was one interesting thing that happened, though, after the comparable worth success, was that the next year the state looked at a whole bunch of classifications and assigned the starting wages to different classifications. This was something the union had nothing to say about.
The different pay ranges, you mean?
I mean, I'm sorry, different classifications to different pay ranges. So they took predominantly male jobs and assigned the starting wage rates lower. And this was essentially paying for the comparable worth. And there was a lot of resentment about this. And inside the union, there were two fights about it. One fight was to say, let's publicize this, let's talk about this, let's have the unions be involved in fixing this. And half of the union said, no, let's have our friends, the Democratic legislators, get on our side and fix this. And of course, it never worked.
Yeah, it was a deliberate effort by the employer to create hard feelings among the workforce.
And it worked.
That, you know, men and I was also a blue-collar worker for the state at the university, and I heard, for years, I heard men would say that we paid for comparable worth, meaning not everyone, but like me and the, and the guys that I work with now make less money because of comparable worth. You know, a classic employer divide mm-hmm. and conquer thing. Okay, well, help me out here. What's something else that interested you during your time at the state or your political life in general?
Well, one of the things that interested me anyway, and I'm sure Mary has, was that if we got involved in this, it helped enormously to get involved in the Labor Federation and in other things, because we supported other labor unions when they went on strike or when they were having some fight with management. And they, in turn, recognized us and helped us out. And so people weren't in their tiny little capsules all by themselves. Now, it didn't always work. And sometimes people would say, oh, I'm not, you know, they're not in my union, so I'm not going to help them out, kind of thing. But every time something worked, it helped other unions to see what was going on and to see that that was a strategy that was very helpful.
Yeah, to no surprise to anyone who's been paying attention, the unions aren't doing nearly as well as they were. The Walker attacks on public employees really had a big effect on it. So, you know, I guess I don't know the point I'm making that this all continues. Okay,
what we're seeing right now is a great hunger for unionization among a lot of sectors of the working poor working class. And you wouldn't be too paranoid to think that it looks like the powers that be is doing its level best to make it very difficult, if not impossible, to maintain the existing unions, let alone create new ones. But we all have to lend a hand where we can and make sure that we hear people who are talking about bread and butter union issues like benefits and retirement and health care, et cetera, so that we don't leave people who want to be unionized standing out by themselves.
And a lot of political things are not disconnected. So an enormous amount, I think, of the attack on immigrants is not just an attack on immigration by itself, but it also means it's a way of keeping immigrants from being involved in labor union activism. Because if you're terrified about the fact that you're going to get deported, you're much less likely to start trying to organize a labor union in your workplace. Although Mary's right, it's very exciting that there are places, food service all over the country, coffee shops that are starting to look at unionization that 20 years ago people would have snickered if they saw teenagers, young people, people of color being involved in all these unionization attempts. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is. The service sector, I mean, there's this idea that factory jobs paid well just by the grace of God. Factory workers made a union wage because people fought and died for those unions. And there's no reason that service sector unions couldn't be organized as well. You know, I don't think they have a contract yet. If you look at Starbucks, there are just under 600 stores in the United States, including some in Madison, who voted in a union. So, you know, I think
But the employer has yet to agree to come to the bargaining table.
That's true. You know, the employers these days take a very hard position, knowing that the courts are going to back them up. And, you know, the old tradition of unions, you know, the whole thing, by the time I became a worker, unions were established that, you know, in some industries, it was just part of the landscape, you know, and, you know, so you got a job at the state or at an auto plant, you joined your union. That was a later stage of development. There'd been a lot of really hard fighting to get to that point, you know, to get to the point where the unions were recognized and had legal rights. That wasn't won through clever marketing campaigns. That was won by people striking and occupying their workplaces. So, you know, the backing of unions seems to be, you know, very broad among young people. I actually think the unions need to step up their game and welcome them. You know, so we have, there's a cultural thing there between the old school AFL-CIO and the young people who are trying to organize in the service sector. And it's a challenge that, you know, the young people are going to overcome, I'm sure, but it's not going to be pretty in the meantime. Look, you two are supposed to be the stars of the show, and it's about your political life. So, do you want to talk about?
I just wanted to say that the whole thing about gender and race discrimination has not gone away. Just because unions are better now than they ever have been at fighting it. If you look at the statistics in the United States, there are jobs that are still, and they're the best paying jobs, that are still discriminated against on the basis of gender and on the basis of race. And it's still going on, and we still have to fight about it.
Yeah, I think it's one of our biggest problems. If you look at the way that immigrant workers have been played against native-born workers, you know, I mean, it's just a classic divide and conquer thing, to where now immigrant workers are public enemy number one. And I think because of the shortcomings of the unions and the Democratic Party, you have workers without any real political home, and it's being used to keep us divided.
Well, that brings me around to one of my favorite subjects, which is the epidemic of loneliness and mental health, mental illness in our society. And I think the union historically has provided people with not only a political home, but a social and cultural home, which kept a whole generation or more feeling better about themselves and feeling better about their neighborhoods than we do since then, since those institutions have started to wear away. And we're all seeking to find ways to rebuild those relationships, whether you call it a union or you practice long enough with organizing so that you learn to organize in an efficient way that speaks to people's needs. That's what I think of when I talk about democracy or think about democracy. There's nothing that's better than working together to achieve an end and hoping that it's a good end and not a selfish end. And people are willing and happy to engage in that if only somebody shows them sometimes mm-hmm. the path. So that's why I still have hope for the union movement and similar organizations that don't call themselves unions but behave kind of like that. And some of our newer political organizations are trying out some of those techniques. So I'm thinking of one of my political homes, which is Progressive Dane here in Wisconsin, in Dane County, or Moses, which I'm also a member of, mm-hmm. which works on the carceral state and getting people to give up their preference for punishment and look harder at rehabilitation and making a new beginning for people who have been incarcerated.
One of the things about incarceration and the enormous over-incarceration we have right now is that also affects employment, because many, many times if people have some kind of prison record, it means that management is not going to hire them. Mm-hmm. And it means that then they aren't involved in labor unions, they aren't involved in workplace energy, and those things are very, very, very connected. And unions have to understand that it's in their interest to argue against the over-incarceration, especially the racial discrepancies and the over-incarceration in this society.
Yeah, and the incarceration causes other problems in that it affects the way that represententation in the government is distributed based on, people that are locked up are counted as residing where the prison is. It also creates a body of people who have a vested interest in those prisons remaining. So in some states, the prison unions, prison workers' unions, are a very powerful force because there's so many of them. And, traditionally voting for the Law and Order Republicans.
And spending a lot of money.
Right.
Campaign.
Mm-hmm. Which takes money out of the rest of the state budget. It could be spent on health care or education or housing improvement.
Okay. Annie, you have any political gigs since you retired that you want to talk about?
I did until COVID interrupted many, many of them, as I'm sure that's true for a lot of people. Once you're retired trade union activist, you can't do much about trade union activism except show up when somebody says, we need a lot of warm bodies on this demonstration. And of course we all do it and we like doing it. I was involved in like Mary, I was involved in some prison reform stuff and some prison visitation stuff where I'd take parents to visit their children.
You mean the other way around? You'd take children to visit their parents?
Yes. I don't. What did I say?
You take said children, you'd take parents to visit their children.
No, take children to visit their parents and also facilitate communication between parents and their families. A lot of that kind of thing I hope to resume. But the prison stopped a whole lot of it during COVID.
Right, yeah. And you're also involved, not as much as Mary, but you're involved in some electoral politics. Progressive Dane.
Progressive Dane. All our discussion about how trade unions shouldn't be so wedded to the Democratic Party doesn't mean that electoral politics aren't very, very important and that we shouldn't get people involved. Also, incarceration has another layer with that, where a lot of people, not so much in Wisconsin, but nationally, who were formerly incarcerated are not eligible to vote. And in Wisconsin, a lot of people think that if they were formerly incarcerated, they're not eligible. They don't understand that they are. And also, it means that that time period kept them out of involvement in electoral politics, and so it doesn't resonate as much on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got a couple minutes left.
Well, can I say one word about another organization that I'm active in or used to be, and that's the League of Women Voters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are not a partisan organization. They don't endorse candidates. They don't go door to door for candidates.
About 1 minute.
But they just issued a call to action on the SAVE Act, which some of you may have heard of. The SAVE Act is going to make it much harder for someone to register to vote.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, Mary, because the engineer tells us that we're about out of time.
Oh, okay.
So I want to thank Mary Anglim and Annie Habel for cooperating with me doing this show. I want to thank Emmett, the engineer, for making us sound so good. And I want to thank WRT for providing this forum where anyone with an axe to grind or a story to tell can get on the radio. I'd encourage more leftists to use it. So thank you, WRT. Thank you to our listeners. Good night.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living.
You've been listening to The Access Hour. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not necessarily represent those of the station's board of directors, staff, or programmers. Please remember that this show relies on your ideas. You can submit your idea by clicking on Sign Up to Host an Access Hour in the WORT website. The Access Hour is anything you want it to be.
You've been listening to WORT, Back Porch Broadcasting, Madison. Next up is Something Wonderful with Ryan Parks.
The Barrymore Theater presents Dan Savage's Hump Film Fest, 20 years and going hard, Saturday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. Hump has been serving up hot, heavy, and hilarious dirty film shorts to the masses for two whole decades, and we're kicking off this milestone year with the first of two all-new lineups for 2025. The mission of Hump is to create a public space for sex positivity, representation, and inclusivity, which, given our modern circumstances, is more important than ever. These are films made by real people for real people. More information at BarrymoreLive.com. The Barrymore Theater presents Dan Savage's Hump Film Fest, 20 years and going hard, Saturday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. You are listening to WORT Madison.
When you're no longer here with me, well, it feels like something's missing. Would it all just dissolve?